All right.
Welcome to Mountain Stage. Actually, this is just our regular show, but this is Hugh Blumenfeld, our friend, and one of the great singer-songwriters here in Connecticut, or anywhere else for that matter, with one of our favorite songs, Good Humor Man, which we actually play the recorded version of sometimes. You know, we play, every time there's a snowstorm, we play your song Blizzard. I don't know, we don't give you any royalties or anything like that.
I keep looking for my ass cast page and don't see anything.
but on the other hand, we do promote your CDs while we do that. I don't know if it helps at all. But Hugh Blumenfeld was with us. He's probably performed in the studio, on our show anyway, more than anybody else. Yeah, I think he holds the record. And that's the wonderful Kristen Chenoweth, who's currently performing in Wicked on Broadway. And it sort of sums up a lot of things going on in the world right now. We do want to talk a little bit about the president's press conference last night. Also, kind of an interesting little development in the exciting world of John Rowland. Just down the road from us, too. His brand new Bristol development, which we're
great,
will be called Helmecky's Landing.
Really happy to hear that. I think, you know, Bristol deserves something like that. What do you think?
This is sort of an amazing story. The governor shows up yesterday at the beautiful AquaTurf in Southington, talking to some kind of Central Connecticut Chamber of Commerce or something like that. And he announced that he's going to pump $45 million into rebuilding downtown Bristol.
Great.
Replacing a decaying mall with a recreation complex and a performing arts center and stuff like that.
Wow.
My understanding is, maybe I'm wrong about this, and maybe Mark Ryan will call me up and contradict me about this. My understanding about this is that I don't think anybody really knows where this money is in the budget or anything like that. It's supposed to be $15 million a year for 3 years out of the state's Urban Block Grants program. Maybe it's earmarked there. I don't know. I've heard different things about whether this money really exists anywhere or not. But I'm sure if the governor wants it bad enough, it can be found. Here's the thing, though. Like, where did this come from? First of all, the people of Bristol should be very careful about this because, in fact, the governor has a little bit of a habit of showing up in other places. Particularly when he's in trouble, he's in an election or something like that. He'll show up at some place like Norwich or, most significantly, Willimantic. Remember he showed up in Willimantic and he was going to do all these great things for them?
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
For the election.
He followed through with that, didn't he?
Well, it turns out when he said, I'm going to really be paying attention to Willimantic, he meant, he's going to be like closing down social service clinics. They certainly got a good...
It's a matter of interpretation.
Yeah, what it's like to be. So be careful, because you can be seduced and abandoned, people of Bristol. And he...
Why would he care so much about Bristol?
Well, this is the interesting part. One of the people representing the town of Bristol is a fellow named Bill Hamsey, who I understand is a pretty good guy and I believe a Republican legislator. But he's also on the House Select Committee. Now, this is the important part.
Really?
This is why you go to the AquaTurf and tell Bristol they're getting $45 million, but only if you're the governor. These other governors you might have, if, for example, I were to be impeached, I'm not so sure they'd give you any $45 million. So, not that this was ever said out loud, but if you're somebody who cares about Bristol and the future of downtown Bristol, as we all do, you might want to go, I guess, talk to Representative Hamsey and say, hey, don't impeach the guy. He's going to give us $45 million. This is what's called trying to buy your way out of trouble. Not the first time he's done it, but it's an especially effective one. This is beyond, you hear the term pork kicked around. This is beyond pork. This is like wild boar. You know, this is sort of something that's so brazen and so obviously an attempt to get to somebody that, if you want to read more about it, there are articles in both the Bristol Post and I believe the Meriden Record Journal both covered this fine event yesterday.
This is shocking.
Yeah.
To think something like that would happen.
Anyways, he says, in that way that he always talks about how that, there's great good times are coming, and there's going to be somebody down here. He could be crowds down here every weekend. Remember that? He said, you're going to see office and retail take off like nobody's business. Like nobody's business. The governor said, great things are still yet to come for this great city. Now, it is actually literally true that... right before the election, he told the local editorial board, I think at the Norwich Bulletin, Norwich is next. Norwich is next. You might want to call up Norwich, the people of Norwich, and find out whether they feel like they turned out to be next. Willimantic, of course, he did visit right before the election. and said that he was going to do great things there, too. He'd be back. He said he'd be back. So you mid-sized towns, I think he said in the State of the State address this time that basically he'd accomplished everything he needed to accomplish for big cities. Big cities, I think, are by and large fixed, according to the
I think you can see that. All you got to do is take a look around.
Yeah. So
just drive around, take a look around, and you can see they've been fixed.
So anyway, there's that to talk about. But people of Bristol, just let me just say, count your fingers and your toes and your silver and stuff like that, and really don't take off your clothes for this guy until you see the $45 million, if you know what I mean. I would really make sure that that stuff is in the bank. Because he's got kind of a habit of promising more than he really can deliver. I'd like to see, I don't know, I mean, I'd like to know what Mark Ryan thought when he heard that $45 million was suddenly going Bristol's way.
That ought to be enough to put up a new parking garage. I think we'd get pretty excited about that.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, if there is to be some gigantic new shining mecca over there in Bristol, we would like it to be called Helmecki's Landing. Not only in honor of Tim Helmecki, our feckless and woebegone producer, and now he's an engineer, I don't know what he is here, but in honor of
wire jockey.
His Uncle Dave Helmecki, too, who actually offered to take the $45 million and run it up a little bit at some offshore casinos and stuff. Leave negotiations between him and Governor Rowland are still going on.
We haven't heard a lot from Uncle Dave
Neither has anybody else. No, he's doing timeshares down in Maryland. I'm sure it's
doing time, did you say?
No, timeshares.
Oh, timeshares. Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, well, we need to talk about the... give me your sense of the president.
Pathetic.
Yeah.
Just plain pathetic.
I really thought this was kind of an amazingly... It was bad. It was really a bad performance. I mean, he really did seem stupid. I mean, he didn't answer questions. Now, he probably was told not to answer too many questions.
Well, then why have the thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And really, there's this one incredible point where, you know, he was asked about the mistakes he might have made, if he could identify any mistakes, and he just completely went up on that one and choked on it, and he said, I'm sure something's going to pop in my head. And I think most of us were watching thinking, well, we're not sure that anything ever will pop into your head again. You know, your head doesn't really look like a place where things pop in pretty often. And
is it pop in or pop in your head?
Yeah, I mean, you could pop popcorn inside his head. There's, I really was sort of alarmed by, his really inability to sort of conduct, yeah, I'm sure something will pop in my head. I don't want to sound like I have made no mistakes. Maybe I'm not as quick on my feet as I should be coming up with one. Boy, we could give you a list. But
I think people sitting in front of their TVs going, hey, over here, I got one.
It was obviously a lot of the questions. First of all, one thing that you can see from this from the press conference is this is a press corps that has decided it hates this guy. They liked him in the beginning, but this is a press corps way, way, way out of the same orbit with Bush. They don't like him anymore. And they want to ask him questions that he doesn't want to answer. And they want to ask him no-win questions like, what mistakes have you made that you wish you hadn't done? Do you want to apologize? He can't apologize. He's really at a point where it's too late for him to apologize. And any kind of apology he makes now is basically raw material for Democratic campaign ads.
Did you see the question from the PBS guy that asked him if he felt like he was a failure?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sitting there going... You know, wow.
Question after question sort of enumerated all the things that were going wrong and all the ways in which, you know, the Iraq policies and dysfunction and the 9/11 stuff. And I thought Mike Allen, not the guy in the plane, but Mike Allen, who was for a long time a New York Times reporter here, I mean, he really went after Bush on the question, why do you need to go to the September 11th commission with Dick Cheney in tow, or the other way around? And, you know, particularly in as much as they asked you guys to do it the other way, they asked you to go in one by one. And he didn't answer that question. I mean, he gave an answer. It was simply not an answer to that question. We do have some people calling in here.
Yeah, here's Greg in a car. Greg. Thank you, Dido. I just want to quickly mention we don't have a lot of time here, but I'm scared that I'm going to be up in Springfield tonight and not sell or sign any books. I'm at this kind of nice event tonight up at one of our favorite places, the Big E. It's in the Carriage House at the Big E. It's a benefit for a women's scholarship program up there, I think.
If only I weren't doing something else.
Yeah. But I mean, and it's pretty expensive to go to, but it's a wine tasting thing, and apparently there's going to be great wines, and you can just stuff yourself with those. And then a lot of authors signing books. Julius Lester will be there. Madeline Blaze, who wrote In These Girls, Hope is a Muscle, which is a great women's basketball book. She's going to be there. Michael White, who's a terrific writer.
But you're the headliner.
I'm
I'm a mid-list writer at this thing. But anyway, it starts at like 5. I won't be up there until after the show. I'm going to drive up to Springfield after the show. And there's going to be lots and lots of wine. And you have to pay like $50 to get in. But then I think you drink as much wine as you want. And you buy books and we sign them. And nobody knows me in Springfield. And nobody's going to buy my book. And I'm anxious about it.
Oh, I wouldn't say that's the case. I think you're going to be a hit.
Anyway, let's take some of these calls here.
All right, here's Fred in Hartford. Fred.
Hey, guys, I don't know whether or not you noticed this, and maybe you did. I don't know what's up with this flyaway haircut that they gave Bush for last night, because it seemed that what they were trying to do, since they know that he's not a rocket scientist, is try to give him the Einstein look, I guess. Because, you know, if he's not a rocket scientist, he can at least look like a rocket scientist.
You wonder, he looked like Christopher Lloyd or something, you know, in a lot of this.
I just didn't get it. I think it's the gravitas type of situation. They're trying to show that he's got the vision thing and the gravitas thing going for him. So they try to make him look like the job's been wearing on him and he's really concerned.
I thought he was going to get into a DeLorean and go back to the time before September 11th, you know, and make it not happen or something. But anyway, thanks for your call.
Okay, here's Carl in the car. Carl?
Good afternoon. I'll make it quick. I know you're in a hurry, but
Wall Street today, the head-banging heavy metal music may be okay to listen to while driving, but stay away from some of the older classical stuff. Britain's RAC Foundation has named Richard Wagner's fast-paced Ride of the Valkyries as the top tune not to listen to while behind the wheel because it says research shows loud music can cause accidents. Three modern songs also made the top 5, including Firestarter by Prodigy. The foundation also provided a top 5 list of songs that can be played safely while driving, though it cautions the volume should be kept down. That list includes Nora Jones' hit, Come Away With Me. Bill Pierce, WTI.
My greetings now is John Dean. I probably don't have to tell you very much at all about John Dean, who counseled the President of the United States in 1970. Of course, that was Richard Nixon, and we pretty much know how the story unfolds. We're not going to waste any time telling it right now. His book is called Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, and he's with us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. You know, one of my favorite...
Bruce or Colin?
Oh, this is both of us. We're both here.
We're both here.
You may speak to us in the plural if you choose. One thing that I love that you did in the book is you called up Arthur Miller or emailed him or something, and I guess that he'd already written something about the acting skills or the staging skills of presidents. And as I was watching President Bush last night, I was thinking, I bet you Arthur Miller has given him an even worse grade now. What did you think of what you saw last night based on everything you've researched about this?
Well, you know, given the fact he's somewhat modeled his presidency after Ronald Reagan, I'm always surprised when he does this. I refuse to accept any responsibility stance that he occasionally takes, and he's now taking. Ronald Reagan, it was just the opposite. He did accept responsibility. So it was somewhat surprising, but it is totally consistent and just further evidence of the material I've laid out in the book. These people are just not going to let you in, if you will.
Your book does a very nice job of anticipating the moment that we're at right now, and there is mention of Richard Clark, and there's a lot said, more than I've seen anyone else say, about the role that the Dick Cheney may have played in, first of all, quelling attempts to do anything about terrorism prior to September 11th, and in fact also making us maybe less effective in investigating September 11th afterwards. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. First, let me just step back a little bit and say that, you know, I see a situation here where you have virtually a co-presidency, and this is based on rather solid information from both inside and stuff I've been able to corroborate from looking from the outside.
Boy, was that ever a question he didn't want to answer last night. Mike Allen from the Washington Post got up and asked him exactly that question. Why do you and Dick Cheney need to go into that hearing together when the commission has asked you to do otherwise, right?
Exactly. And his explanation told us all exactly what the answer is. He needs Cheney. He's a good head of state. No question, he looks good out there. He dresses up well in his blue suits and red ties or multicolors like last night on the television. And he likes to grip and grin and is a good retail politician. Cheney, on the other hand, likes none of that business. Bush does not like policy. Cheney does. I don't think he's stupid, but I do think he's ignorant, and I think it's by design and inclination. So to go in there to the 9/11 Commission without Cheney, I think Bush would be totally lost. I think he'd be a fish out of water and wouldn't be, he would embarrass himself.
But one thing that you say in your book, and I haven't heard much, I've watched a lot of the 9/11 Commission's hearings. As a matter of fact, I'm addicted to them, but you talk about the Hart-Rudman Commission, which was a bipartisan commission on terrorism. You say that Cheney shut that down and kind of substituted his own judgment for its judgment, right?
Well, not only Cheney did, but Bush did. They did it at the very time when Colin Powell was going up to the Hill to testify about terrorism. And to send the signal out early that morning, Cheney went on CNN and said, listen, we're not doing anything with the Hart-Rudman Commission, which had a recommendation to deal with terrorism at the top of their list. It was the very first thing they thought the new president should look at. This was a bipartisan commission, had a lot of experience, had about a $10 million budget, and had about two years of study on the issue. And rather than accept any of that wisdom, or they just ignored it and shut it down, and Cheney was delegated the task of dealing with terrorism. They put a small sort of operation into FEMA, the emergency operations into the Federal Emergency Management Agency, but did nothing. And Cheney sat on it until it arrived on his desk on September 4th.
Talking to John Dean, his book is called Worse Than Watergate. Let's go back to the premise of the book, and you address this in the book. But it's a very serious thing to use the term worse than Watergate. You've used it. Chris Matthews has used it. Watergate was very serious. We're talking about burglars and flush funds and a real kind of abrogation of democracy. I mean, is the Bush administration really that bad?
It is not a title I would use lightly, and I'm certainly never going to be considered an apologist for Watergate or Nixon. But it is, to me, a situation that is, I think that title fits perfectly. While I don't claim authorship for the title, I certainly have adopted the title. I believe it's an accurate title. It is both declarative, it's subjective, it is obviously provocative, and it's, in a sense, interrogative. It raises questions as well, and it fits exactly what I lay out in that book.
You know, you talked specifically, too, about Bush's management of the press and about cramming them into the old press room that Nixon created. Although last night they were in that big room. And
only the third time in this presidency.
Yeah. And, I mean, I just in a general way, I really thought he was awful. I really thought he actually seemed kind of fuzzy and non-responsive and really unable to answer questions at all.
Well, you know, I get a little uncomfortable watching him because he seems uncomfortable. I saw last night something else that I talk about in the book, how he's one of the few presidents other than Nixon who've ever talked about the presidency in the third person. He was doing it last night, talking about what the president does. And I also cite in the book examples when he gave an interview to Woodward, he's talking about the president. Nixon did the same thing. The president does this, the president does that. These are men who don't seem to quite feel comfortable and fill the whole job, unlike many who do. You almost had to pry Bill Clinton out of there. Ronald Reagan certainly filled the job and enjoyed the job. Both Nixon and Bush, 43, the first chance they get out of the White House. Nixon would go to Florida or Key Biscayne or out to San Clemente. Bush goes to Crawford or Camp David. Nixon also used Camp David. They like to get out. They're not comfortable in the White House for some reason.
You know,
but there are also presidents who have known the presidency before they got there. Nixon, in the sense that he studied the presidency under a man he respected, Dwight Eisenhower. George Bush, in the sense that he watched his father as president and got a first-hand view of the office.
We're talking to John Dean. It's called Worse Than What. I heard you in another interview talk about how Condoleezza Rice, had she been testifying in a real court under the rules of real court, might have been found in contempt of court because her answers were so non-responsive. That trend seemed to continue last night. Obviously, that wasn't a real court either, but he just, both Rice and President Bush didn't seem to answer questions at all.
No, they're not very interested in responding to specific questions. As I say, a part of the pattern of obfuscation often and image making. They have raised 9/11 and terrorism as a campaign issue. This president is campaigning on this issue. They are doing everything they can to keep the terror in terrorism rather than the reverse of trying to make it less frightening for Americans. And, you know, I suspect as the campaign goes on, they will even exacerbate that situation and make it even more frightening. and trying to convince voters that they're the only people who can handle this potential problem.
The last question, because I know you got to go. You talk about scandals at the end of the book, and what I'm wondering is, based on your knowledge of what happened during Watergate, based on whatever you hear from whatever sources you have in Washington right now, do you think that the Bush administration is in crisis mode? Do they see themselves now as similarly besieged by scandal and public mistrust the way Nixon was towards the end of his presidency?
I don't think they see themselves in that condition right now. I think rather they see themselves in campaign mode. And everything, in fact, the entire first term was devoted to how do we get elected to a second. Almost every decision was made with that in mind, rather than what was the broader public interest. It was how do we get ourselves reelected. And I think if they get a second term, it will be obviously not how we get reelected again, but how can we succeed in making more Republicans control every branch and inch of this government for the future.
Well, I'm assuming we're looking at Jeb versus Hillary the 4 years after that anyway, so that could be an interesting battle of wills. Listen, thanks for being with us. The book is called Worse Than Watergate, the author, John W. Dean. Just for the record, well, no, we'll get to that later. I mean, I guess I'm sort of becoming more and more obsessed with this. Bush's presentation last night. I'm just, so my mind is boggled by some of this. And actually, I thought maybe one of the great questions of the night was asked by Terry Moran from ABC. He was the one who said, before the war, you and members of your administration made several claims about Iraq, that U.S. troops would be greeted as liberators with sweets and flowers, that Iraqi oil revenue would pay for most of the reconstruction, and that Iraq not only had weapons of mass destruction, but, as Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said, we know where they are. And how do you explain to Americans how you got that so wrong? And one of his answers was that he does have the chief U.S. weapons inspector in Iraq had confirmed that Iraq was, quote, hiding things. They're hiding things.
Yeah.
And a country that hides something is a country that is afraid of getting caught. So see, if you're hiding something, that means you must be afraid of getting caught. And if you're afraid of getting caught, that means you must be hiding something.
I see. Well, that's crystal clear logic to me.
And he also said that he's really looking forward to seeing where these weapons mess. So it's like in some kind of board game, and he really wants to know how it comes out or something. I don't know. I just, his answers, I've just been going over the transcript again. His ability to not answer these questions is kind of incredible. Do you want to take one of these fine calls or not?
It matters not to me.
Let's take one.
All right.
We don't have a lot of time, though.
Here's Joseph in Hartford.
Hi, honey.
Bruce, don't refer to me that way, Colin.
All right.
What is your position on the death penalty, Bruce?
I'm totally against it.
Wait, same as Collins? Or go ahead, answer. Is it your
agenda? Do you want an answer?
Well, the Red Sox have another night off, and Johnny Damon will use the time to appear at the local theater in his one-man show, An Evening with Charles Manson.
No.
It's time for Sports That's Why, the very French sports discussion segment. I think Mr. Ambrosio, Joe Bruce Evans, and myself, Louis Scandalier.
Now, this is a reason. Well, the UConn football coach talking about the spring game.
I always love
that. At 6:15.
All right, here's the question for Mr. Ambrosio. Dear Mr. Ambrosio, we hear a lot about the speed of light, which means that light moves from place to place.
Yep.
Does darkness move from place to place? And if so, what is the speed of dark?
Hello, darkness, my old friend, as Simon and Garfunkel once said. And it's something that at the Institute, we take a great deal of pleasure in. Darkness does not move. It is the lightness. It is when it is light that causes the darkness to go away. Mm. And when the light moves at the speed of light, which is a figure that we can't even calculate so quick, then the darkness is overridden. But it's always dark. It's dark 24 hours a day, especially here in the jock prep room between 10 and noon. But it's always dark 24 hours a day. It's always dark 24 hours a day, and it's just when the light, the sun, appears on the scene that the darkness is overshadowed, because light is stronger than darkness. And you know, that's a lesson we can live through life, guys, that light is better than darkness. So even when you're depressed about having to work an extra half hour, if you put on a happy face, things are always much better.
So beautiful.
Raining all the time.
Well, one of the little tempest going on right now is that James Sensenbrenner, who's the House Judiciary Committee Chairman, has called on Jamie Gorelick to resign from the September 11th commission. Jamie Gorelick, I happen to have sort of a man crush on, and she's my favorite Beatle, too. The issue is, I guess I didn't get to see a lot of Ashcroft's testimony yesterday, and then we kind of were flung from that into Bush's disastrous press conference, and I kind of missed some of the Ashcroft stuff, but apparently at one point he produced a 1995 memo written by her talking, urging a separation of normal criminal investigations from counterterrorism within, I guess, the Justice Department or the FBI or something. Ashcroft said this created a conflict of interest, the fact that she'd never written anything. Well, they knew she was Deputy Attorney General at one point when they put her on the panel, so. And she's been pretty good about recusing herself. She didn't even question Louis Free because she felt she had a conflict of interest. And Thomas Kane, the Republican chairman of the commission, has responded to Sensenbrenner by saying, why doesn't he just mind his own business and stay out of ours? So he's also indicated that he supports Gorelick. He feels that she's one of the hardest working and least partisan members of the commission. So there. Plus, I just wouldn't be able to go on living if she were thrown off the commission. So.
Your life would be destroyed.
It would come very close to destroying me.
We got, it's bad enough in here now. We got Mr. Ambrosio is upset about having to do the extra half hour of sports talk because the Red Sox got rained out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I could deal with you going off the deep end.
Right. Plus, we have Tino calling up. Speculate a little bit on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I listen to you all the time and admire.
Speculate a little bit on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I listen to you all the time and admire Mr. Ambrosio, but this time I think you inadvertently got a question that has an answer. I believe the physicists have shown that if you interpret darkness to mean shadows, then the shadows do indeed move faster than the light.
Well, all the questions that are asked of Mr. Ambrosio do have answers. And Mr. Ambrosio's judgments on those matters are not reviewable under the terms of our agreement with him. So it may be the case that you feel that you know better than Mr. Ambrosio, but in general, my advice would be not to ever say that to him.
Especially today.
Today in particular would be a day not to say that to him.
Well, I would not say he's wrong. I think it's the interpretation of a shadow as being darkness.
Whatever. It doesn't make any difference. The decisions of Mr. Ambrosio are not in any way reviewable, and however much anybody might want to. That's just sort of the way things are.
Especially today, since we're in the studio, you're not.
If the president can refuse to answer, to answer questions or to, why can't we? Basically?
Imagine if we asked Mr. Ambrosio if he'd ever made a mistake.
Talking to Aaron Brown, so I don't want to bring up anything too major. But I was, I've been thinking about this for a couple of days. I was moved by the story that yesterday was the birthday of the world's oldest known living mouse.
What?
It's a dwarf mouse named Yoda. It turned four on Saturday, which is roughly 136 years in human years. We talk about dog versus, this, as a human being, this must be 136 years young, they say. Young, not to curse ourselves. And I felt a friend, a guy named, a mouse named Alan. Alan was his name.
Right,
He would just wash his face, his little snout, I'd say. What are you doing? You just go wash your face, you snout all day. You should go out. Enjoy cheese. Go for a walk. Look at the sky. That's what keeps me 136 years young.
Yeah,
I'm just amused by it. Apparently, dwarf mice, it's kind of like, little dogs live longer than big dogs, overall. A dwarf mouse, which is a genetic abnormality, is going to live... can live longer than... I sound like Mr. Ambrosio, don't I? I sound like I'm giving him...
Yes, you kind of do.
But in fact, if the genetic mutation, it chokes off production of growth and thyroid hormones, and so dwarf mice tend to grow to only about a third the size of your normal mouse.
Huh.
But then they tend to live about 40% longer. It is similar to small dogs. But the problem with dwarf mice is that they're so small and frail, they require the constant company of a larger mouse to keep them warm. They need a big mouse.
This is getting...
This is really true. And Yoda is the name of this... Did I say it was named Yoda?
You did.
Yeah.
Mention it. Yeah.
Yoda is the 4-year-old mouse. 136-year-old mouse. I don't say 136 years. I say young. Young, not to curse ourselves.
Yeah.
Does
it have its own lightsaber?
His companion is Princess Leia, who is a full-sized mouse and gives off a lot of warmth, if you know what I mean. You should see the mouse I'm dating right now.
Yeah.
Much younger and taller, too. I love the tall mouses. I've been waiting the entire show to do my 136-year-old mouse impersonation. I want you to know that. I've been holding back. But anyway, we were supposed to be joined by Aaron Brown. I have a funny feeling it's not going to happen.
We are scheduled for Aaron Brown, and we end up with a mouse.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. Well, you got
to
do something.
I had to be ready with something.
I know. You got to. The show has to go on.
Yeah. Since Aaron Brown isn't here, we would welcome your phone calls. If you want to talk a little bit more about the president's appearance last night,
which of course you would.
Yeah, I would. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, he really, it was like president. It was like Boo Radley was president of the United States or something. You know, I was like.
It was frightening.
It's like, he can't really answer your question, but he would be willing to leave a little toy in the tree outside your house, maybe.
What was the deal with the hair?
Well, I don't know what the deal with the hair was. The hair is connected to the brain, and the brain was not working. I mean, there are so many ways in which I thought that is, I mean, the 17-minute long prepared thing was all about making sure that sympathetic TV producers at, you know, news stations and stuff like that would have something to cut up. They'd have something to use. And, you know, and even unsympathetic people or neutral people would be in a similar position of having usable tape where he didn't sound like a yut. And so they gave him 17 minutes of prepared stuff just to go over and over. And I mean, for example, here, Bill Pierce is out in the newsroom. Well, he's going to get something on the air for 9 o'clock. Well, he winds up using some of the prepared stuff because he gets that first. And so that's good media strategy. Bad media strategy is letting President Radley go out there in front of the press and try to answer any questions at all since he doesn't know anything. All right.
Here is Susan in West Hartford. Susan.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Well, you sort of beat me to it there, Colin, because I was going to say, you said a minute ago that you thought his appearance was disastrous, and although I didn't see it, I read a lot of the coverage.
Okay, we got a bunch of calls on the board. We're going to take them as fast as we can, which means we probably won't be talking around, but we'll see. Here's Lori from Weathersfield. Hi.
Hi.